I've been getting a few more questions and comments coming in from email, so I've decided to put this all into one place, and we are going to talk about some of your questions and comments here. I will first of all say that I have been getting comments from Instagram, Facebook Messenger, Facebook, an audio recording, an email, well, emails through info@tenttheology.com, emails through my personal account, and emails through my work account, and texts. So, if I have missed some of your questions, it's because of my bad accounting and record keeping, not because I am ignoring your questions. So please do send them again, and perhaps centrally send it to info@tenttheology.com or to the email address that's at the top of any emails I send you if you are on my mailing list. That's the two best ways to get in touch with me. Otherwise, your messages might slip through the net. And again, as I say, that's just because of me. It's not because of you. Let's go into some of these questions. We'll just see what happens. I guess I haven't got great answers to everything, but they're interesting, and it'd be lovely to engage more. Caroline W., she asks a question about, have any people groups, and she's specifically here thinking about nations and different nationalities, have any people groups fully grasped Jesus' message about brothers and mothers, etc.? And here Caroline was wondering about the idea that Jesus seems to be so ambiguous, or at least not, he's not a traditional family values kind of guy, I think is the best way to say it, and that his approach to family is always slightly on edge, slightly edgy, and it always ends up putting people, well, he does say in one place, doesn't he? He says, I haven't come to bring peace or unity, but division. Father will be set against brother, daughter will be set against mother. And it's not, when Jesus says those kind of things, in the Gospel of Luke, that is, he's not saying, I am an agent of wrath and anger and division. He's saying, my presence will bring a dividing line. People will have to make some kind of choice about me. And those choices are, look how often those choices are directly impactful upon your family relationships or the set of inherited expectations that come from being a member of a certain tribe or family unit. That's the kind of division that Jesus always brings. And the Gospels, every Gospel is filled with those, and they emphasize it in different ways. But Mark is certainly no different in that Jesus reframes and sometimes directly attacks. Who are my mother and my brother and my sisters? You are my mother, my brother and my sisters. Anyone who's with me. Sometimes he directly attacks the idea that blood family is commands your highest authority. And other times he just seems to implicitly assume it, or that seems to be what happens when people leave everything they have. They leave the family jobs. They leave the family homestead in order to be part of the Jesus movement. There just naturally will be a rupture. And so have any people groups fully grasped this, Caroline? No, they haven't. And it's interesting to point out that everywhere where Christianity takes root, every culture where Jesus has taken root, some of the first effects of that will always be this kind of rupture with family that I've just talked about. I can't think of a single story of any church history or missionary anecdotes or missiology which doesn't reflect that this is what happens. This is one of the first victims of the way of Jesus is family loyalty. And children will be set against their parents, or parents will be set against their children. Not because Jesus is preaching violence against these things. In fact, he explicitly wants you to honor and to love, right, your parents, and to love your enemies. But it's also to point out that how often one's parents will be one's enemies when it comes to Jesus. And also other way around. I know parents whose children are opposed to Jesus, but the parents are not. I can't think of a single people group or culture for whom this isn't true. It always happens. It's always a disruption. And basically what has to happen is identities and the awareness of where your allegiance lies, you know, where your duty lies. Those kind of things always get reframed and reconfigured whenever Christianity takes root. And that's in totally unchristianized cultures. That will always happen. I can't think of any exceptions. But then in Christianized cultures, the same thing happens. It's just that the tribe or the home group or the ethnic bloodline, they now associate themselves with being Christian. But it still happens is that once people start following the way of Jesus, regardless of whether their home group calls their home tribe calls itself Christian or not, the way of Jesus always ends up setting people away from the group they were born into and into something else. It just happens all the time. Kierkegaard, the Danish philosopher and rabble-rouser that I mention from time to time, he talks about how being a follower of Jesus will always be a minority pursuit. That the way of Jesus always seems to be taking people out of their majority view and into a minority view. And that he says it's always the counter to a culture. It's always counterculture. And what it counts as culture might change. So it's not that the way of Jesus is always conservative against liberals, or it's always liberal against conservatives, or it's always capitalist or always socialist, or whatever human man-made ideology you care to come up with. What actually happens is that wherever there is a overarching culture in which everybody just assumes as a matter of common sense, the way of Christ will always seem to be foolishness to that common sense. So this sort of is like a statement you can make that no matter what kind of family or what kind of tribe or what kind of nation or what kind of ideology you find yourself in, you can be assured that Jesus will always be providing some kind of counter to that. He will always be subverting it in some way, and he will always be offering an alternative, essentially, come out, repent, come out of the old systems that are part of your identity and come into mine. And sometimes, you know, I mean, a cliche would be in a culture which is overarchingly dominated by collective communism and atheism, then materialism, then being a follower of Christ will be to emphasize the individual and the spiritual nature of life, or the freedom that comes from personal responsibility. And in a culture which is overarchingly dominated and addicted to freedom and personal responsibility and capitalism and all that kind of stuff, then the counter to that culture will be an awareness of our collective need, or that no one exists by themselves, or that you're meant to sell all you have and give to the poor. There's just always something that Jesus will counteract. And our job, I think, as followers of Jesus, is to constantly be aware of what is now the dominant narrative. And if there's a dominant narrative and lots of people speaking with one voice, then who are the people not being allowed to speak? Who are the groups that aren't having their story heard? Well, it usually ends up being those are the groups that Jesus is identifying with or wants us to identify with. And that just happens over and over again. and then the way history works is those minority groups will themselves might become dominant, in which case we now need to identify with the minority groups again, whoever happens to be the counter to the culture. And so that happens with families, and it happens with any national culture. So I've never identified one national culture, Caroline, that seems to have really caught this. What I have identified is there is not a single national culture that doesn't in some way represent the truth of Jesus' statement that I am not bringing unity but division. My way will set families against themselves. And that does happen all the time. Anna H. asks a question from Mark 6. She makes a comment about John the Baptist being beheaded. It struck me as resembling the story of Esther in the Old Testament. Ah, yeah, that is a good point, actually, Anna. I haven't thought of that. I confess I haven't done work on that. But the story of John the Baptist and where Herod has his daughter dancing and then he gets her to, he says, give me anything you ask. That definitely has an Esther twinge to it, doesn't it? There definitely is something going on there. And I think it's like I said before in my thing about Mark 6, my talk, there's this idea that King Herod is aping the grand kings of old. So like King Xerxes was this mighty magisterial ruler, and the way he operated in the story of Esther was that he could hold these grand banquets and he could have a nationwide search for the next wife. And, you know, he acted this way, monumentally corrupt, monumentally self-absorbed, monumentally in charge. And so King Herod now is acting like that. He's trying to act like that. It's like he saw legends and stories of what it is to be an emperor, and now he's trying to act like that. But it's pathetic. It's kind of grubby and pathetic. So yeah, I do think the Esther story has relevance to this story, for sure. And then the story of the feeding of the 5,000 strikes Anna H. as something to do with Roman cohorts, because 5,000 is one of the numbers that the Romans used to organize their soldiers. So when Jesus is giving the crowd an order and splitting them into smaller groups, it's like he is forming his own Roman cohort, only to dismiss it and overturn expectations later. So first of all, Anna, I think that you're onto something, and I also think this is going to be related to another story which another reader has commented on. And I think you're right. I don't think that it's as easy as saying Mark is deliberately making the parallel that the 5,000 are like Jesus's new army, who he then dismisses to make a overt statement about military power. I don't think it's that straightforward. But what I do think is happening is Mark often uses language that evokes the sense that Jesus is a leader or a military leader. And he does order people around, and it comes up in the herd of pigs as well, which I mentioned and which we're going to talk about in a second. Mark deliberately slips into military style language and has Jesus barking orders at the garrison of pigs. And it's like he's just signaling, hey, guess what? we also have a ruler. He also gives orders. But as you rightly point out, it's like, well, one, what happens when Jesus gives his orders to his regimented followers? What does he do to them? Does he create an army and then go storm Jerusalem? No, he disperses them. And yes, I think you're right. I think there's a constant underlying motif going on here of Mark using kingly language, using military imagery and suggestions of military might, and then he never really comes to any fulfillment that the world would recognize. So again, he subverts the language even as he's using it. I think you're right. So this is Jason H's point as well. So Jason H was asking about Jesus and the legion and the pigs, which is where Jesus destroys them, or he sends legion into the pigs and then they are wiped away. They're taken out of the system. And it does seem, and he's wondering whether this is Jesus destroying the imperial might. So these unclean spirits are done away with through the pigs. They're drowned in a way that other unclean spirits in Mark we don't really find out what happens to them. Whereas in Legion story, we're specifically told what happens to them and then that they get destroyed. And certainly, as Jason points out, there is something here of the chaos of the water, a chaos of being plunged into the sea, that there's something here of the chaos of creation. Again, Mark is peppering his account with little suggestions that are evoking feelings, even if he's not coming right out and saying it. But is there something here specific about Legion? Does the Roman demons coming to their messy end signify some sort of teaching moment about what Jesus thinks about Rome? Which is interesting. I do think so. I mean, is Jesus, Jason asks, is Jesus making a strong statement about violence and militarism in particular here? I think that would be going too far. Jesus will make strong statements about violence and militarism later. And they do come up in Mark. So he's definitely, put it this way, Jesus looks way more like a pacifist than most Christians want to say. And he looks way more like a non-violent, he definitely is against using organized violence to defend oneself and one's land, even from foreign invaders. And we'll get to that in a bit. And the story of why Christians don't want to believe that is a story that's very interesting indeed. But certainly in the Gospel of Mark, in any Gospel, one will find Jesus who is setting himself against the prince of the power of this age, which is essentially nationalistic violence. That's essentially what it comes down to. That Satan is the semi-divine being who's in charge of domination and power and nationalistic inspired violence. The violence that protects what is rightfully mine from people, for people who look like me and sound like me as much as possible. That impulse, that human impulse that I'm going to protect my patch of land and it's just going to be for people who look like me and sound like me as much as possible. Jesus sets himself resolutely against that. And at points he talks about that impulse or that satanic impulse as being cast down. So, you know, there is clearly also something going on here when the Romans and that whole region where the Legion live is so identified with Roman military might, setting itself up to squash and protect, to squash revolt and to protect its own resources. That whole area is associated with that action. And so when Jesus sends Legion into the pigs and destroys them, I think that is definitely part of it. Even though that isn't the point where Jesus makes an explicit statement. But it's just part of his mission statement. It's happening all the time in different ways, in different places. Sort of related to Ross L. sent me a message about, you know, the essence of it was his reflections on partisan politics and the inability to communicate of partisan politics and how Ross is writing from an American context, and he just sees that it's almost impossible for red people to communicate with blue people, for example. And I think you're right, Ross, and I totally hear you and I see that. And I will be talking more about Jesus's response to what we would recognize as patriotism, good old-fashioned patriotism. We're going to relate Jesus to that aspect when we talk about render to Caesar what is Caesar's, so which is coming up. So I think I might pass over that at the moment. But I will say, I mean, as a headline, it's related to the Caroline's question above, and it's related to the other questions we've had about any group, any organized group which tries to claim that they are based on Jesus and his teachings, or which loudly and sentimentally use Jesus language, will inevitably and always becomes itself the group which needs correction. I've never seen an exception to it, and I certainly don't see an exception to it right now. You show me the groups that are loudest and most sentimental about Jesus, and I will show you groups that are also the most enthusiastic about killing enemies, about denying justice to foreigners who are least likely to want to seek genuine economic justice. These will be the groups that are most addicted to patriotism and most addicted to thinking of their flag or their nation as some sort of revelation from God or some sort of light to the world. The groups that are the most sentimental and vocal about how much they love Jesus often are always also the groups that are enthusiastically standing for everything that was Jesus was diametrically opposed to. I don't know how much clearer to say than that. And we'll talk about it in a bit, but you just have to see it. And the only reason that these Christians don't see that is because of their patriotism, because people's prior commitment to the success and triumph of the nation into which they were born or the culture in which they were born, it blinds them so that they cannot imagine that anything Jesus said or did would ever hurt that nation or that culture. Well, of course we shouldn't obey. Of course we can't obey the Sermon on the Mount when it comes to public acts, because you can't run a country that way, which is pretty much the basic reason why most Christians don't follow Jesus, because you can't run a country that way. And they're right. You can't run a country according to Jesus' teaching. Which tells me something about what a country is. And it tells me something about Christians who think that their role in life is to make their country the best country it can be. Because it is actually impossible to follow the way of Jesus and to be a nationalist. Because nations require acts and attitudes that are against everything that Jesus said to be or do when it comes to your enemies, to the poor, and to foreigners. So again, I don't know how else clear to say it, but we'll be talking about that later. But yeah, the partisan inability of groups to talk to each other usually comes down to the fact that Christians love their partisan groups more than they actually love the way of Jesus. And you see this all the time. And I think that sort of partisan tribalism or partisan, that the hard little unit of being around people that look like me and sound like me as much as possible, I think when you find that, you definitely find that that is a more popular, more powerful, and more successful attitude in the world than the gospel is. And as I've said before, that doesn't mean that the gospel is wrong. It doesn't mean that the partisan loyalty is better or truer than the gospel. It just means it's more successful. And most of the time when you find people who, even if they claim to be Jesus people, they don't actually want to do anything that will hurt their partisan loyalty. And one sees that all the time. And again, no matter what type of ideology is behind it, left or right or blue or red or liberal or conservative or socialist or capitalist, whatever the primary partisan loyalty is, you will find Christians love that more than they love the way of Jesus, which is to love your enemies, which is to lay down your life for your friends, which is to find an identity and an allegiance that is not based on those things that we would call partisan loyalty. So there's a lot there. And we'll be talking about it. I mean, I literally write books about it, which does lead me to some other questions here. Joe D and also Ben G. Joe D and Ben G both ask me about books or podcasts that I've, what other things I've done or I'm doing. I do write books. I've written a number of books on this Soren Kierkegaard, which you could definitely check that out. I'm not hiding. It's not hard to find. I wrote a biography of Kierkegaard, but which also includes introductions to all of his books. Now, Kierkegaard was a primary critical of patriotism. For Christian reasons, he was against the idea of Christian nations and Christian cultures and Christian patriotism. So I also wrote a book on Christian nationalism. I used Kierkegaard to critique Christian nationalism. That's more of an academic book, and it's quite expensive. But, you know, if anyone here is interested, if you want to email me, I'll send you a free PDF. It got published by the Oxford University Press a few years ago, but I can happily send you a free copy. And the biography is called Kierkegaard, A Single Life. That is available wherever one buys books, and you can get it on audio or Kindle or in paper form, and that was published by Zondervan. And I've also published some history books. I published the Zondervan Essential Companion to Christian History is my latest book. Again, easily available. where everybody finds those kinds of things. And there are some video series as well that I've done for Zondervan, for the publisher, which you can purchase if you are interested in hearing more of my voice, which I don't imagine you would be, but there you go. And then I've done some other chapters in books here and there on nationalism and the religious aspects of patriotism, Kierkegaard, political theology, those kinds of things. I've done stuff here and there. And then Joe D. asks if I've done any Bible studies on other books of the Bible. And I, not yet, I am going to. So I'm thinking of probably doing one on Acts, maybe Luke Acts, because Luke Acts as one book. So, but we'll see, that would be a mega project, but it could be really fun. I have done a lot of stuff on different books of the New Testament, so maybe I'll just put together a series and just talk it out. Just keep going and we'll see what happens. So we'll be in touch about that. But do send, if you have any ideas of what you would like to hear from, do send me an email and we'll see what happens. Jason, Ben F. Ben F. has some questions about the wrath of God. Jesus claims his judgment is not to judge. This is in the Gospel of John, which I referred to. He made me wonder whether he was really meaning, this is my judgment, I'm not going to stop you doing what you want to do. Oh yes, the question here from Ben F. is the idea that if the wrath of God is like, to be understood as something like, God just letting you suffer the consequences of your own actions, you get what you want, and that's experienced as the wrath of God, then when Jesus says, I'm not going to judge, is that like Jesus creating a safe place in which you aren't going to play out the consequences of your actions? I'm not going to stop you doing what you want anymore. The non-judgment, the stabilizers have been taken off by man's capacity for evil and good, with the coming of Jesus making the entire environment a fundamentally safe one. All right, Ben, I've made a mincemeat of your question. I think you are asking something like, when Jesus says he's not judging, is that like him saying he's creating a space in which we will no longer experience the consequences of our actions? And I don't think that that's true. I might be misrepresenting your question, and if so, I am really sorry. I don't think that's what's going on, though. I think if you go and look at John, Jesus is... there's a lot of judgment language in John. But Jesus does judge, and there's two things he does. One thing is he does judge people by declaring their identity over them. So I declare you no longer servants, but friends. That's a judgment, for example. The other thing that Jesus judges quite severely is Satan. So he judges the ruler of this world. So he reserves his judgment. It's no longer the humans who get the wrath, but he does show up and expose the schemes of Satan, the ruler of this age. That's who he casts down and that's who he judges in the book of John. So that's worth looking at. And then the schemes of Satan, or the way of the world, is often identified itself in a way with the wrath of God. So if you live by the sword, you'll die by the sword, is a good example of you experiencing the wrath of God. And this gets mentioned in Romans 13, where the rulers are it's their job to wield the sword to mete out God's wrath. And you do see that happening in the early Christian imagination, that the wrath of God seems to actually be disassociated in some ways from the way of Jesus. And it sometimes, it's not the wrath of Jesus. It sometimes seems to be talked about more like a force of nature, or just the law of consequences is experienced as the wrath of God, or it's described as the wrath of God. And there does seem to be the more personal nature of the judgment of Jesus, which doesn't get talked about as the wrath of Jesus. In the final book of Revelation, Jesus there's some violent imagery for sure. There's some wrath-dealing imagery for sure. It's worth paying attention who actually gets it and what actually happens. The various nations of the world fight each other and experience the violent consequences of their own addiction to Babylon, which is portrayed very much in terms of marketplace ethics of buying and trading and selling and exploiting, and then they experience a violent end as a result. So there's, again, a little bit of a sense of you're going to die in the bed that you made, and that does seem to happen. So I don't know if Jesus is, I don't think the early church is imagining a space in which we are no longer going to suffer the consequences of our actions. I don't think that's what's going on when Jesus talks about not judging humans. I don't think that's what's going on, because in fact, it's almost the opposite. He says, I don't judge you. You are judged by my words. So I've the light is here. I've said it. So now you get to choose. What are you going to do about it? And if you don't follow Jesus, then you will experience what it is to not follow Jesus, to be outside of the light of creation. And what that looks like is the prince of this age, the accuser, the constant scrabbling to protect what you think, the meager resources that you think are rightfully yours, the addiction to taking a human life in order to solve a problem. These are all the ways of the world, of which Satan is said to be the Lord. And so living in the world is its own punishment. And so if we choose not to follow Jesus' commands of I do not leave you as orphans, I will give my Holy Spirit, you will go on being filled, lay down your life for your friends, do not fear, do not be anxious about anything, all these kind of activities that come from following the way of Jesus, if we just decide not to do those things, then we will be living under the prince of this age. And that is a form of hell. And that itself is the punishment. I think that those, especially the Gospel of John, makes those dichotomy quite stark. Naomi B. writes with a question about the messianic secret. She basically says she lost her notes and she can't remember where I first started talking about that. Naomi, the messianic secret is the language that biblical scholars use to describe that element of Mark where Jesus is constantly telling people to be quiet. Whenever they say he's the Savior or the Messiah, he always tells them to shut up or to stop talking, or he runs away, or demons will say, we know who you are, you're the Son of God, and he will rebuke them. Peter, you know, gets rebuked. So what is going on here? And the language that the scholars use is the one of messianic secret. And the messianic secret shows up as early as Mark chapter 1. It's a common feature of the gospel. And what's happening is that Mark is showing Jesus going through essentially a re-education campaign where he has to teach people to relearn the language of the Messiah. When they use the language, they think that it's a nationalist folk hero, Braveheart type figure. That's who they're really expecting. And you see this happen a lot in the Gospel of Mark. People are waiting for that kind of folk hero who's going to come and redeem the people at their greatest hour of need, like a King Arthur, maybe. And so they often refer to King David in that situation. And Jesus has to tell them, stop using that language. You don't yet understand what it is to be a Messiah. It's not going to look like what you think it's going to look like. So this is the motif in Mark, that Jesus keeps his status a secret. He doesn't deny it, but he also takes active measures to rebuff people and to re-educate them. And he's not actually seeking to create a huge army or mass of people around him. This isn't what he's doing, and he's not attempting to gather an army in order to retake Jerusalem, for example, and kick the foreigners out. The other reason why he says it to demons is that there's this sense that if you can name somebody in the first century world, then you are somehow naming their destiny as well. And you see that the villagers in Jesus' hometown, they do this. When he's doing miracles, they say, who are you? Who do you think you are? We know who you are. You're the son of Mary. You're the son of Joseph. We know your brothers and sisters. We know you. So we know your destiny. And this is a form of having control over somebody. So likewise, when the demons are speaking out that they know who Jesus is, that is them not worshipping Jesus, but attempting to control him, to control his destiny, to say, we know where you came from. We know what your purpose is. And Jesus does not want a demon to be having that sort of authority or to be pronouncing on his mission. Because once again, the demons don't understand his mission any more or any less than the humans do. So that's why we get the messianic secret in the Gospel of Mark. And then it's relevant when the messianic secret gets revealed as well. And when Jesus decides to show himself or speak plainly, these are always significant moments in the Gospel. So there you go. That's the messianic secret. And you will hear me talking about this many times before the study is done. Anyway, lots of good stuff there. I hope you don't mind my rambling as I've been thinking about this as I read your questions. But very good to hear from all of you. Please do keep sending any comments and whatever that you have. Anthony R. sent in a really fun article. There's a village, the village where Jesus, the 5,000 are fed. Archaeologists think they've discovered that village, which is quite a fun thing. And so it's worth having a look at that. The Independent, the UK new independent newspaper, has come up with the town where Jesus fed the 5,000. Thank you, Anthony R., for that. And thank you, everyone, for bringing in emails and comments and questions. Do keep the word going. Do pass on these details to anyone. And let's keep raising some funds as well. I still have a few £100 to give away out of the fund, which is really great. And I'd love to be able to give away more. All right, friends, that's enough ramble for me. We will pick up our Mark studies in the next episode.